Thank you for joining me for another Blunt Business on CannabisRadio.com. Welcome to the program. Wherever you find the program, which is Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, YouTube Music, Amazon Music, all the major platforms, and of course through CannabisRadio.com and the Cannabis Radio app. My next guests, they are representing a cannabis practice where launched over 10 years ago. One of our guests has extensive experience in corporate mergers and acquisitions and tax law, with a particular emphasis on regulated industries, and the clients for both are rely on them to advise on complex financial transactions, mergers and acquisitions, and divestitures. So I'm joined right now with the cannabis practice at Dickinson Wright, Scott Crow and Benjamin Stopcheck. Thanks for joining us, gentlemen.
How you doing?
Just needed a hurdle on that last name, Benjamin. That's what I wanted to get through. So
close enough, man. Don't worry about it. Just keep rolling.
So just to give the interview for both, I just may mention where Scott comes from in terms of your 10 years of this cannabis practice for both of you in this together. And Ben, for your experience, litigator serving outside general as outside general counsel, providing regulatory and transactional-based services to cannabis companies across the U.S. and Canada. And before you joined Dickinson Wright, you were chief legal officer for a vertically integrated cannabis company. So you have hands-on experience in the grow, seed to sale. You understand it very well. So now we have two major parts we're going to cover on the program, and this is going to be a two-parter. So we can go ahead and make sure that we can separate two major subjects we have in the space. Later on the second part, we're going to talk about what's going on in 2026 when it comes to legal ramifications, financial, business, and the looming debt crisis, a $6 billion debt cliff. But first was a fascinating subject that was brought on about private equity cannabis. Now, first of all, I want to take from a story from Westward that it reiterated here on the program several weeks ago, where they talked about the major tax breaks that could come to the cannabis industry to the amount of $2.3 billion, according to estimates. And one of the areas they did talk about was, you know, the fact that the tax write-offs from the Section 280E that can be taken away once reclassification comes in for cannabis from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, that one of the things would happen is taxes can now be taken off where you're not being charged on your gross income, but your net income. There's more to that.
But yeah.
I'm being, you know, a little bit part of that. But now the other thing is that they mentioned private equity. And one of the issues that has been the cannabis industry has dealt with for a long time is the fact that they've always had to go ahead and they want to be able to finance growth internally. They want to be able to show more growth, but they've had to go and show retained earnings that there's always a low rate of year-to-year growth with cannabis companies because of how much they get taxed on the gross income and not the net income. So for investments to finance growth externally, they have to go through, without the banking services as well, the full complement of banking services, they have to worry about where they can't go to commercial banks and public capital markets, they have to go to private capital for loans. And in the meantime, that's going to be something they got to deal with in the meantime until reclassification happens. And for some people, they're saying, oh, it might happen right away. Could happen 2 to 3 years down the line. So with that in mind, Scott and Benjamin, what do you say about this part that until we get the reclassification, which might open some more room for banks and more public shareholders, more places to go and get capital, private equity is going to have to be the place to go.
Go ahead. And then I'll jump in, man.
I mean, moving to Schedule 3 is not going to open up banking services from national scoped banks like PNC. You know, those banks are not coming in under Schedule 3 because all cannabis companies are still going to be illegal, just in like a less illegally way, right? Like Schedule 3 drugs are created by pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutically graded labs that are prescribed by doctors and sold by pharmacies. That's not what's happening at the weed store. So it is true that the 280E will go away, meaning that you won't get taxed if you didn't actually make any money, right? Like all in and considering all expenses back and front end. But I don't believe that that Schedule 3 is going to mean that the biggest, you know, FDIC-based lending banks are going to come in. I do think that private equity will come back in again because they'll see opportunity to catch the margin. But Scott disagrees. Let's go.
I think there's an issue. Ben hit the nail on the head for the same reason that your senior lenders, Fifth Third, other, you know, PNC, your typical lenders, bank, you know, JP Morgan, they're not going to lend in this space because it remains illegal, because it's still a scheduled drug. The same will likely ring true for true private equity. Most of those funds have what are called sin clauses in their investment documents, which prohibits them from making investments in illegal markets or illicit markets, which would include cannabis at the current state. So I don't think that 280E is going to open up a full set of banking and full set of private equity funds. You may see some smaller banks that start to think harder about lending into the industry or the establishment of more or newer private equity funds, because the tax benefit is real if 280E is gone. To Ben's point, if you're not making money, you won't be paying tax, which is not true or has been true as history has dictated for the last 10 years in this sector dealing with 280E. But I'm also not sure that the savings are going to be as big as everyone states, because most of our clients, not all, but most are already and have been taking the position for the last several years that 280E doesn't apply to their business. They haven't, in fact, been paying that tax. It's always been, since the position of, you know, opinion letters came out that 280E doesn't apply and you started having businesses taking that position that it doesn't, there's this potential looming bill in the background that if they're not correct, the IRS is going to come collect at some point and argue that 280 did apply to your business during those time frames. So I think that the 280 movement, while it has value, I'm not sure that a large part of the country is not already taking that position. So it may not really change from a financial reporting or tax reporting standpoint.
Now, I come from the radio industry initially before coming here and in the podcasting realm. And one of the things I saw from the time that I joined the industry, and then once I got into podcasting and the radio is just starting to make a full change, is what happened with deregulation in that industry, because it just opened the door. We had so many radio companies that were buying other radio companies and buying so many radio stations and just incurring so much debt. And then when another company bought another company, that debt would just go ahead and continue to mount up and just get put on the books and they'll figure it out later. But they were allowed to get away with that. And then now we have some of the largest radio companies in the country that are now operated under private equity. And to me, when I hear the name private equity, I feel like it's vultures. Like, I feel like we have vultures that are coming in. They're just going to pick away at the company itself, take whatever they can get to profit and monetize, and then micromanage and scale down as much as possible, down to the bare bones, if it means they could see them keep a profit. And that's one of those things that I would be afraid of, that the cannabis industry would suffer from. What do you say about that?
I think I come from private equity, and there are great private equity groups, and there are groups. Look, it's a very relationship-driven environment at the end of the day. When you're taking on private equity, you probably have a six-month time period where you get to date them and understand who they are as people. And sometimes those deals work out and sometimes they don't. So to your point, if the company's doing well, typically private equity will start to push more money into it, grow the business, come up with a business thesis. Like, they don't come in just guessing at what they want to do with these companies when they make an investment. There's a business thesis. There's a plan of attack to grow the business, grow through organic growth and through acquisition is typical, a common path that you see when private equity shows up at your door. But to your point, if things don't go well, they hold all the cards to essentially step in and take over the controls of your business. And unless they're well experienced in weed, they're going to take the next step, which is to try and salvage what they can get from the business and sell it off, either in whole or in piece. The problem is in this sector is we have a very small universe of financial tools that are available to most cannabis operators, unlike the rest of the U.S. that has thousands upon thousands of banks, lenders, and marketplaces to go to seek capital for growth or for working capital. This industry has probably 20 or less major players. So where do you go to get your money to get your replacement refinancing? It's the same pool everyone's swimming in from a fishing standpoint, and there aren't other lakes to go throw your rod in to try and get financing. So it's going to come to a head at some point, which means there's going to be a lot of cooperation in the space. Ben's been dealing with a lot of this on the front lines in the last 18 months with debts that are becoming due, and how do you deal with your existing borrowers?
I want to hit, and I want to go back to one of the first things you said, because I think it really highlights why I find this whole tagline of private equity cannabis interesting, right? When you talked about your experience in radio, you frame that as, you know, private equity or private lenders being strategic and seeing an opportunity to get into that, you know, on purpose. And then they kind of, I presume the underlying punchline is they kind of pulled the soul out of the radio system, right?
Absolutely. Because it's just, yes.
The difference here and why it's completely so interesting is the private equity, the specialized lenders or the family offices, like let's just put an umbrella of that, of like rich people in America and the people who invest their money for them, right, are having to take back these assets and operate them out of necessity, not a directed plan. The plan was never to like be a weed company for these folks. They didn't even want to go on applications 4 years ago, right? Like we spent time talking structure and doing things that were off market to try to comply with the regulations while not even having them being associated with the licenses. They never wanted to touch the plant. The problem is their borrowers not paying them back because the loan terms are not sustainable in the current world. Their only recourse is their collateral. Their collateral is the grow, and they can't resell the grow right now for the same reason that their borrowers couldn't make it work and pay them back. So they're left with no option but to absorb these assets and figure out how to like run them or hold the line with them and hoping things get better. And so, different than your radio positioning, this wasn't on purpose, right? This is a collision of unexpected circumstances for everybody, resulting these high finance groups now having to essentially get their hands on the plant to try to protect their investment.
Now, I would be surprised.
Go ahead.
I would be surprised if you met anyone, to Ben's point, that was in the space 10 years ago that said we'd be sitting here today still with a federal illegal regime. I think most people were hopeful that, including investors that were putting money into it, that this federal looming legalization was coming. And that would open up the door to the market. Assets would be sellable. The entire world of finance that's available to everyone else would come crashing on this sector. And it hasn't happened. And in the meantime, while these companies have grown, they're hitting a wall on what to do with their existing debt. So you see lenders setting up new companies to consume and take over those assets, or they're trying to partner with their good borrowers and trying to get their platforms to consume bad yields that they've made. So not great alternatives either way.
I'm at least happy to say I can go glass half full with the fact that we have seen growth in the industry on a state-by-state basis, and at least that we made that much progress in 10 years plus. But at the same time, you know, the federal part, I don't know if it was ever going to get to that, because the discussion never got ramped up. And whenever you heard anybody go on, you know, any mainstream media broadcast and represent the cannabis industry, they would look bad because they would get triggered by some question and they would have to go and start defending themselves and start going back to some kind of historical, you know, claim about why cannabis is such important and that, you know, everything. It's like they would be easily triggered and the argument would look bad because, you know, that was the image that all these news outlets wanted to go and portray. The constant portrayal of this goes back years, and I've been talking about it for years, even getting conference sessions to talk about the mainstream media portrayal of cannabis. Like, the public image has never been great, but when you see all this groundswell of effort from state by state to go ahead and bring this up, that we're at the point where federal should come across. And that's the reason why President Biden decided to put the request for reclassification and President Trump decided to go and do executive order. So, I mean, it's a bipartisan issue. We know that. And plenty of bills have been written to go and do this as well. But until we get to that point, there's a couple of things in the private equity sector that I want to ask about because of the image that the portrayal of the private equity companies. I want to get into that, but we're going to go take a short break. When we come back, here once again with Scott Crowe, Benjamin Stopchick, the cannabis practice at Dickinson Wright, representing here. We're going to have them back on. They're going to talk more about this issue of the influx of private equity and the kind of capital that the cannabis industry needs right now until reclassification comes in someday. More bluntness is coming up after this. Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with Scott Crowe and Benjamin Stopchick of Dickinson Wright, the cannabis practice. And you want to know more about the firm and you want to go ahead and reach out to them, the website is dickinson-wright.com. Dickinson, dickinson-wright.com. Take a look at the website as we get to you on. Now, the portrayal of the private equity firms out there, and just to unpack a little bit what you said earlier, Scott, yeah, there are some good and very profitable and very financially sound and I think respectable private equity firms out there. I know there are obviously for a lot of places that are, I mean, I look at the restaurant industry. They have quite a few that have done pretty well for themselves, and I'm not taking away too much on quality and not taking away too much on trying to build up. So there's industries where it absolutely works. What is it going to look for the cannabis industry? Because my example of radio, you know, there's a feeling right now where, well, first of all, let's get into the point of why private equity wants to go and jump into cannabis. There's high risk tag right now that's put to cannabis in general. When it comes to radio, there's a high risk because it's a, you know, it's a declining brand of media or a medium that people are not adapting to because of the internet. So when you look at that, what's also the ramp of the amount of profit or how quickly do you want to be able to turn around a profit once they invest? Tell me about that part where when private equity comes in, you said you had the experience coming into that, coming out of that space. Tell me about why cannabis is such a viable opportunity. And is there these tags that is why it can be the place to go to invest?
A couple of things is I think it's actually a tough market to operate in. You go back 10 years and it was an application process, either a lottery or a grading system, and you win a cannabis license and you think all of a sudden you were going to be wealthy. I'm going to be able to sell weed legally. It's going to take off. And then you open the next door and you walk into 1 million regulations that you have to comply with. So it's a very heavily regulated industry, which a lot of the OGs coming out of that were never regulated. They grew great weed, but there were all these new sets of rules and regulations that have to be complied with. So it's a relatively heavy regulated business. So there's tons of risk there for non-compliance fines and penalties, lose your license, a lot of things that can occur. And I think that's why, and you layer in the illegal component on top of it, that's why you see MY private equity in the sector is viewed as predatory. It's not predatory lending. It's putting in proper risk, reward, and returns based on the risk that they're taking. They're stepping into an illegal industry. It's highly regulated. The rules vary from state to state. They change daily from state to state. And then you're dealing with different governing bodies overseeing those state regimes that are either lacking in their efforts to enforce against illegal operators, and you're fighting against that stream as well. So taking all those things into consideration, I can see why private equity would lend money at a 15 to 20% interest rate. Right. It's a very high risk area for them to walk into. So while they technically can be viewed as predatory, I don't think, you can't just paint the entire private equity sector as being bad people, predatory. And I'm not saying they don't exist. And there are groups out there that lend with the intent to take over your assets. But I don't think that was initially the case here. But as Ben mentioned, we're getting to that headwinds where we don't have new groups coming to the table lending money. We don't have new opportunities. So there's going to be gridlock.
And it's part of that was we had a lot of capital that came in to certain companies, and they completely squandered it.
Yeah, I mean, listen, yeah, yes and no, okay? When money came in 2020, 2021, yeah, people spent $10 million on their grow facility, okay? But that's what it costs to build a top-of-the-line facility. I mean, was there the cannabis, like, you know, you go to the bakery and you ask for a cake and it costs $20, and you ask for a wedding cake and it costs $120, same cake, because wedding. So yeah, electricians, all these contractors, everybody put a little juice on their deal with the cannabis companies because they were splashing money around, but still it costs what it costs to build them. The problem is the lenders thought that these borrowers could pay a 16% interest rate on $10 million and make it work. And the borrowers believed the same thing. And inside of 3 years, we all learned that that's not even close to possible. And to that end,
the market gets involved and then the prices start to dip to no fault of their own. And then you're all of a sudden you can't pay your rent because the margins aren't there. Or, Ben, like when Michigan took off, market prices climbed and everyone was in a very good spot for a very short period of time. You take Ohio's marketplace when they went and converted, when we converted to a rec market, it's, I think if you ask any operator, it did not perform as everyone hoped it would be that there would be $3,000 and $4,000 pounds, and it's never gotten to that point. So I think market expectation, everyone was wrong on what was going to occur, and not also seeing the long term. This is a commodity, and more supply means price is going to continue to drop and bottom out. So it's not necessarily that these operators were bad operators or did the wrong thing. I do agree with you, Ben, that yeah, there are cases where that occurred, but the market is as much to blame in a lot of these states for operators failing, either through the state between too many licenses or just market saturation in general.
I'm in Michigan, right? I believe this is the toughest or top three places to survive in the United States right now. Yep. We are $3 billion a year cannabis state, which per capita was higher than California last year. Okay. We smoke and sell a ton of cannabis in this state. Yet, right? In 2020, the average cost for an ounce of fire at the store was like north of $400. Today, it is $59. Out the door for an ounce. I used to buy eighths in college for $55, and it wasn't even good weed, right, compared to this. So, you know, again, everybody thought that it was going to stay on that trajectory. Nobody anticipated a 70% price drop in that period of time. And so now in Michigan, there's probably 20 grows that are for sale right now that are shuttered, maybe more, maybe 50, I'm not sure, that are high-quality buildings with great bones that could be used well, and nobody wants them because it's a bloodbath, right? No one would come in at this point to sign up for that, which brings us back to when you're the lender who has debt out on the old world thinking about what this was going to be from a few years ago, and no one wants to buy the building that you took back. You have to keep the building safe and hope things improve, and then they start saying, well, we could run it and at least try to run it flat, right? So we didn't have to just dump more carry costs into it. And you have, you know, private equity weed spinoffs, not based on a plan, but necessity.
The other thing I want to ask, and then we're going to go to commercial break, was when I look at what private equity needs to look into before they go ahead and make the option to go ahead and invest, do you think they would care about, you know, Scott, you make mention of the compliance standards and all these regulations that all these companies have to deal with once these people invest in and say, okay, we need to make back on what we're going to get from this, plus the interest we're going to get from this. Compliance standards versus if a private equity just wants to be able to go and just do what's the bare minimum. So stay with their bottom line, go with the lowest possible insurance option, catastrophic insurance, you know, in case of a rainy day. And not worry about good manufacturing practices or, you know, if it's, you know, just skate by with what they need, just necessary, while they can continue to go ahead and keep their investment, you know, as little money being put in as possible.
I think people might feel like that, but they're going to get chewed up. If the weed guy got cannabis his whole life that borrowed money from you, couldn't make that building hit under these market circumstances with all the love in his heart, then if you think you're going to run it like you don't care at all at a bottom line and make enough money to not end up in the same place your borrower did, I think that that's going to end up like not working out for folks, you know.
They're very expensive assets to own because there's expense associated with the compliance and regulatory environment. And two, they're very difficult assets to sell. So a cultivation facility, if it closes and you can't find someone in the cannabis sector to buy it, your value that you're going to fetch for that real estate is going to be way less than if it was some other shell or warehouse or otherwise that could be repurposed. But the buildings are built very specifically for a specific purpose, and there's limited uses outside of cannabis for what it would be, other indoor grows, vegetables, tomatoes, things like that. But this is why you see private equity being essentially forced to come in and operate these assets, because if they take possession of them and then can actually get at least the amount of their loan back at some point, it impacts what they're reporting back to their investors as well. You don't want 20 loans written off in one sector because they can't pay. You've got to come up with a different plan to figure out how to deal with those assets. Now, if you're a bank like, you know, a national bank that's got hundreds of thousands of millions of loans, those write-downs don't, they're not as painful and you can take them. You know, although you saw that when we had the housing crisis, they stopped taking possession of those assets for exactly those reasons. There was nothing to do with them. There was gridlock. And that's the problem on a macro, like a much smaller basis that you're seeing in cannabis, is that there just are a limited number of lenders and you're running into the same gridlock. Who's going to buy these assets, and two, who's going to finance the purchase of them? Unless you have groups that are coming with capital. So you're going to be forced to, once you take possession, I think you have to sign up for, we're going to be operating this for the foreseeable future.
We're going to go back to commercial break. When we come back, I want to get into some of the areas of some comparisons that you could put with private equity comes in. I think one of the things too is that when I look at the compliance centers that are out there, I would just want to know that, you know, with private equity, they're going to do the responsible thing and say, well, I mean, there's going to be some necessary costs that are going to have to be incurred because of this, because they just can't run this, just like Benjamin said, they just can't run this, take all the, you know, bells and whistles off of the operation, and I think they're going to still profit. They can't just completely dismantle and disassemble it. I totally agree with that. So we're going to come back. A few more questions, and we're going to continue this private equity conversation to a second part episode. I'm here again with Scott Crowe and Benjamin Stopcheck of Dickinson Wright, their cannabis practice. Again, the website is dickinson-wright.com, dickinson-wright.com. Take a look at the website as we go to commercial break. We'll be back with final questions for this first part. And, of course, remember, part two coming up next episode. But come back to find out what we're going to talk about next. Wrapping up the first part of a two-part episode here with Scott Crowe and Benjamin Stopcheck of Dickinson Wright, their cannabis practice, and we're talking about private equity influx into the cannabis industry and the prospect of it. Now, in the cannabis industry, you have other players you have to work with within the environment, and one of that is you have to kind of partner up with the Office of Cannabis Management or whatever it is, Bureau of Cannabis Control, whatever that governing body is. You have a state regulator to deal with. And there's some mismanagement we've seen, obviously, with New York a couple of years ago. They had to go and just revamp the whole system. We have a rampant black market that is not helping matters either, and that's taking away from any profits. So tell me about those ramifications with private equity, you know, the risks they realize they're going to have because of the regulations and who's regulating it better than others or not, and how they're controlling the black market.
Scott, you want to go first?
Well, I can take the point on the black market. These are just, again, issues that keeps private equity out of the marketplace, yep. That keeps them away from it, is the constant changing of the regulations and the rules and investing into an environment of uncertainty. And if you're going to do that, and you need to set your risks and the returns so that they make sense, which is why you see higher interest rate loans and other things, again, because of the uncertainty in the marketplace, as opposed to the restaurant or alcohol industry that has well-settled rules. There may be some movement and changes on an annual basis, but literally in cannabis, I think there's probably a new rule issued every day somewhere across the United States. The market is not settled even from a regulatory standpoint, not from a federal standpoint. So if you're an investor coming into this space, you know full well there's a ton of risk that you could potentially lose your investment through no fault of anyone. It just someone failed to comply with the regulations. You get sideways with a regulator, and then you're fighting to keep your business. So again, this is just another reason why you don't see as many private equity groups, large funds coming in space seeking investment. Not to say that there's not opportunities to win, because there certainly are, and there have been winners in this sector. There's lots of them that still exist. Problem is the market's more focused on the losers and the pain that the industry is going through. So you don't hear the win stories as much in the public.
I want to focus on the regulatory environment, because that's, you know, what I do all the time. You know, you mentioned earlier the idea of like, well, when the private equity folks become operators, I wonder whether they're going to abide by the standards and, like, you know, public safety and do the right thing. They regulate weed companies like they're making plutonium. Okay. It's just weed. Like, I mean, the amount of stuff that these companies go through and the amount of hours and dollars that they pay me for silly things like 10 pre-rolls, right, were sold that, you know, were trade samples and weren't supposed to be sold to the public. Okay, oopsies, right? That's like 4 months and $10,000 in legal fees, and it all ends with them just giving you like a $500 fine. It's very inefficient, and you're punished for making accidental mistakes. Okay, if you go to any Target or any department store in America, there's, you know, some percentage of loss. People stole stuff. Things fell down somewhere. They don't know where the inventory went. You get punished to death for anything less than perfection in cannabis. So that's really hard. The other point that I want to make is the OG cannabis people, the initial operators, are not all following the rules. They're fighting for their lives right now. They have their normal people who put their entire dreams, hopes, and financial ability behind this business and are, you know, trying to survive. And we all know that when you put people in that type of situation, sometimes they make decisions in the interest of their survival, not necessarily like what's morally right. So, I mean, in diversion, conversion, right? Like half of the distillate in some of these markets is secretly converted hemp with residuals that no one even knows if they're good for you or not and aren't being tested for. So the idea that everybody's doing it for the love of the game right now and private equity is going to come in and like do evil things, at this point, I think everybody's doing it to survive, and there's rules getting broke and people doing things that aren't safe all the time. And if anything, I think the private equity people are further incentivized to not behave like that because they're high-end business people, right? Like most of the OGs came from, everything they were doing was illegal 10 years ago. Like it's not that scary to them to bend a corner or throw some pounds out the back door to make sure they pay their bills and keep their employees getting paid. And frankly, I don't know what choice I would make if I was in that situation, right? Because
to Ben's point, you have operators who operate in an illegal sector who have a very different risk profile in what they're willing to accept than what a private equity partner will accept. Private equity does things with lawyers involved, more lawyers than you would want, to make sure that their investments are being made proper, to make sure that the companies are compliant from a regulatory standpoint. And in cannabis, to Ben's point, when things start going poorly, you have operators that have profiles and start taking risks that private equity may not even know about. Those are the types of same things that keep them out of this marketplace. So it's not just taxes and lack of access to banking. Those are big components of it. It's just the general uncertainty of this marketplace. And albeit it continues to get bigger and larger, despite not having all these tools, which tells you people in America want this product and we need to figure out how to get it to them at a reasonable price, in a reasonable, safe manner, and allow the people that are providing it to make money. And that doesn't exist today, except for those far and few between.
So we're going to roll over this episode into a part two. And I think, Benjamin, how you kind of reiterated right now in terms of preparation for what private equity will bring to the cannabis industry. I want to talk about that coming up in the second part of the episode coming up next week to go into this. But I think one of the things that I want to make a point here before we get into that is that I think a lot of cannabis companies, you know, they did some pretty smart, stealth, strategic things when they started incorporating more Fortune 500 and C-level executives. More CEOs have come from traditional business, familiar with private equity, familiar with investment, and familiar with the bottom line. So there are going to be a lot of companies that believe that, you know, no matter what, the growth of these MSOs that are out there, I think they're absolutely prepared for private equity to come in the space. So that's going to be where they're going to have to go to next to survive and to continue to go and go forward and grow. I don't know about some of the other companies, like you said, Ben, the OGs, the pioneers of this industry, what happens to them? You know, do they get pushed out because private equity needs particular leadership that understands this process and it's not going to buck the system? But there's
that,
go ahead.
Yeah, Rasko, that's not an uncommon theme when private equity comes in. One of the values that private equity does bring is professionalism to your organization. So there are different types of funds. So there's each have different sizes and different types of businesses and sizes of business that they're going to digest. But the smaller, lower middle market deals, which is where the majority of cannabis lives, private equity typically will bring in C-suite executives, help them level up, professionalize their operating systems, professionalize their accounting systems, and add value by putting systems in place and scalability so that these businesses can operate on a profitable basis. So that's very common. Now, the problem is, outside the pubcos that you mentioned, who can afford to pay a marketing exec that left Google or a marketing exec that left some public company? They can't, because they're operating on such thin margins to begin with. There's no cash to attract that professionalism, which leaves you stuck where you are.
Wow. We're going to go into the actual preparation. We're going to go and just kind of ask the questions that you would want to understand if you're going to have private equity knocking on your door and ready to go and come on and invest. We're going to talk all about that. And we're going to go into the debt crisis that we mentioned before. We're going to fall all into that into the next episode of Blunt Business. But before we do that, I want to just make sure to direct people to the website, DickinsonHashWright.com, DickinsonHashWright.com. And Scott or Ben, if you want to just take a minute real quick just to tell people how they can go and reach out to your team if they need your help.
Ben, you want to fire away?
Yeah. I mean, listen, the internet is everywhere, right? DickinsonWright.com. There's a button there that says cannabis practice, not hard to find. You'll see the whole suite of attorneys. You can see where they're located, you know, across the country and what their subspecialties might be. And, you know, we work for a living. So when somebody calls and says they need legal services, we generally tend to pick the phone up and have the conversations. Just that easy. Send an email, give us a phone call.
And we are, just to be clear, we are a national firm. So think of us in regardless of what state you're in, because we have transacted or provided legal support in all, I think, almost every state that's got a cannabis legal regime at this point. There may be one or two where we haven't, but give us a call.
You have close to 24 offices around the country and also offices in Canada, East Asia, India. That's a massive operation. I'm glad I got to have both of you on here, the program, to talk about all this. So, you know, you have so much experience, and then obviously you have clients that can help to really give us a real hands-on bird's eye view of what we're going to deal with when it comes to private equity. So we're going to come back with Scott and Ben on the next episode of Blunt Business. And thank you for listening in. You absolutely must come back for part two. And until we do that, come back in about 7 days and we'll talk to you next time.
Easter should be the best day of the year. It's a celebration of the resurrection of hope. Come to Crossroads Church and celebrate an empty tomb and a living hope. Info and service times at crossroads.net.